Welcome to FSHD Straight Talk, the podcast where we dive deep into living with FSHD. I'm your host, Tim Hollenbach, and I'm on the journey with you. Having FSHD, I understand the challenges it brings to patients and their families. We're in this together, and this podcast is a space where we swap stories, share advice, and talk to experts to get the latest news. There's plenty to say about living with FSH muscular dystrophy, so let's get straight to it. Welcome all to the FSHD Society radio show. No. We're going nostalgic today. I bring that up only because our guest today is going to be Jun Kinoshita. This is FSHD Straight Talk. Back in the day, first episode was Jun Kinoshita. This episode today, we honor the woman that has done so much for the community, and we bring her again into her last possible, right, episode here with Jun as she goes into retirement time of her life, changing the course of her direction and her path and what she decides to do moving forward. That's the spotlight of today's episode. If you want to get in touch with me, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org is the email. Want to hear from you. What should we be talking about? Do you want to spread your story with us and share it? Today we talk about that, how important storytelling is in our community, how important it is to get the word out. The FSHD Society has evolved, it's changed, it has grown. The volunteers have just absolutely driven this machine, and the staff there has grown as well, driving more force forward. Jun Kinoshita has been one of the original, I guess, people within that office. She talks today in the episode about the early days, which was just three people in that office, to evolve to what it is now, the different roles she's had. The way that she has joined her skills of journalism, science, communication together and kind of done so much within the society. She talks about certain pinpoints in the path of the growth, if not just within her career of the FSHD Society, but the growth of it as well and certain changes and transactions that have happened. Talks about how Mark Stone, when he came in involved and how she thought to herself as she was proposed the idea of being in that role, but then thought, wait, what's better for the community? She talks a lot about that we before me mindset, selflessness. I do ask her a tough question because she's that type of person that doesn't think of herself first. She thinks of others, about what kind of legacy or what would people remember about her in the FSHD Society. Tough question for her to answer. She answered it very well, of course. And of course, she deflected it as she always does so well to others that helped her get to where she is and what she's done. She talks about her new path forward and the certain nonprofits she's going to continue to work with that she started up that she gets to devote more attention to. No surprise, she keeps moving forward. The advice she gives a lot is, to me, is she talks about don't forget what you're doing, who you're doing it for. She uses the term serving others, servant leadership. We have so many volunteers and staff that are those types of people. They're servant leaders. They lead by serving. The advice of keep telling the story is really poignant to me. This is a human disease, June will say. You know, this doesn't affect the animals. This affects humans. We have to keep that in mind as we push forward to treatments. Definitely a cure. And she also touches on the fact that she believes the future is bright. And granted, we've heard that a lot and people are still impatient and we're waiting and we need it. We need it now. And I get it. We're still pushing forward as June has done so much with the FSHD Society and our community. She is known very well. I asked her too, even about her earlier roles when she was that point person for emails and calls and so forth, sharing some of those personal stories, people she would connect with, and how realizing, yes, this is definitely a human disease that we cannot lose sight of the human element to it. And the voice of the patient we touch on and having that evolve and even naming it correctly to be more impactful. So this conversation was just fantastic. It was a little sad in a way for me because episode one was with June. The person that reached back out to me when I wanted to start the podcast was June. And then now to sit and most likely could be the last interview with her in this platform was a little sad, but fun. Enjoyable as always. Just a great person to talk with and to share stories with. So I hope you enjoy this episode here with Jun Kinoshita. Enjoy it. And yeah, nostalgic to say the least. Hi, everyone. I've got some exciting news for you from the FSHD community. If you've ever felt the unpredictability of FSHD or wish there was more accurate research and information out there, and I know you have, then listen up. I'm thrilled to tell you about Better Life FSHD, a groundbreaking new research platform from the FSHD Society that's changing the game for those of us living with FSHD. Better Life is your one-stop hub for tracking symptoms, accessing personalized resources like articles and videos relevant to you. And the best part, as you take surveys and track your symptoms, you provide FSHD researchers with better data to understand this complex, understudied disease. And a better understanding can lead to faster treatments, something everyone, every one of us can get behind. So head over to betterlifefshd.org and join the study. It only takes a minute to get signed up. Together, we can change the future for everyone affected by FSHD. I've done this. It's a simple process. I challenge you to do the same. Again, that's betterlifefshd.org. Now let's get back to the show. Welcome. This is the interview of interviews that we have. As we said before, hit record. Maybe this is like a bookend to some degree. We have Jun Kinoshita here. Everyone knows her for the FSHD Society and FSHD community. Been here a long time. We are celebrating a career, granted not ending yet, but we're definitely at a touch point where we're closer to the retirement date than when you first started, right, Jun? I mean, we're walking that direction. Yeah. And you were episode one in this crazy project called the FSHD podcast back when it was called FSHD Society Radio. We used Blog Talk Radio. You remember that? And
yes, I do.
Things were live even sometimes, and the evolution of kind of how this has gone. And for me, that all started with an email to the society, and you were the person that answered back. And then so it went. Seemed like always, you were always the pioneer type spirit in my mind, where you were willing to kind of go different directions, kind of get the word out. And I'm honored to have you on again. And all the things you've done for the community, for the FSHD Society, your involvement. So we're definitely spotlighting you, right? So it's okay, June, to be a little selfish here. You're not normally, right? You're always about the group, but we want to know more about you and like, where did this all start? You know, some know you, they know where you are maybe at this point of your career, and some may have known you the whole way through. But others, you know, kind of want to maybe go back to the way back machine. What was that first interaction with the society like back then?
Well, I mean, it was really serendipitous. I mean, I had been working as a science journalist, and then I got involved with a large philanthropy that was involved in the Alzheimer's disease space. And I founded a nonprofit called the Alzheimer Research Forum, which it still exists. It's altsforum.org, if anyone's curious. And it is a kind of a news center for all research in the Alzheimer field. And it's a community. The top thinkers in the field get, you know, exchange ideas. It's very lively. And so I wanted to, I guess, use web technology to kind of transform the research world, to get people to communicate better, communicate faster, all, you know, to try to get accelerate, you know, towards a treatment. And Alzheimer's actually still pretty far from what I think is a real effective treatments. But it was a great background to have, total immersion in, you know, the whole research to, you know, bench to bedside world. With that background, I think someone, a headhunter, contacted me, and the society was looking for a new executive director. And at that time, it was really tiny. The founder, Dan Perez, and an office manager, Doris, who's was wonderful. I didn't know anything about FSHD, but of course I looked it up right away. Came across a New York Times article from 2010 about this is, one of the genome's greatest hits. And I read the Science paper and I thought, wow, this is the best drug target I've ever heard of, because DUX4 doesn't seem to really have a vital function in adults. So you could knock it down. There are lots of ways to knock down genes like that. And but you're not going to have a side effect. Like in knocking it down, you're not going to, kill the person, right? Or cause some
Right, or something
major,
drastic. Yeah.
I mean, there might be some, it's not like it's totally not doing something in the adult, but it's, generally the whole reason the disease occurs is because our cells, our genetic mechanisms have a whole process to keep it shut down. Like it does, you don't want to turn it on, and that mechanism breaks down in various ways to lead to FSHD. So
Right,
I
it's
thought
meant to be shut down, right? I
it's
mean,
meant to be quiet,
naturally,
shut
yeah.
down. So I just, at that point, I'd already been working in the Alzheimer field. I don't know, oh my gosh, about 15, maybe call it 20 years. Anyway,
Wow.
it
Yeah.
was like at this point, I would love to really help get a treatment across the finish line, really, really get to patient, get it into patients. And I felt that with FSHD, there was a chance, that we could do that. But I also knew there were big challenges. I mean, as an organization, we had to transform from just having investigators say, here's a scientific idea, and we want you to fund it. And we raise funding, and that's kind of it. I felt like we needed to educate and then mobilize patient communities on a much bigger scale, because this is a human disease. Like other, mice don't really get it. Even, other, laboratory animals don't normally get FSHD. You have to genetically engineer them to mimic FSHD. So it's not like, you give a virus to a mouse and it dies, and then you develop a treatment and the mouse lives. It's much more complicated. You need a mouse that does something like FSHD. Anyway, that, they're imperfect models, but so you really need people to step up in a large way, allow, volunteer for studies, volunteer for natural history studies. And I was hearing a lot of people saying, well, may I might volunteer for research if there's a clinical trial. And I would explain, like there will never be a clinical trial if you don't get
Do the
involved
research part.
sooner, and donate some blood and let, participate in genetic studies and natural history studies. So I think, there's been a steady drumbeat. I know everybody's heard it from us. That was not, that, and that was because I was hearing, these, understandable points of view. And I'm going like, okay, we have a lot of work to do to help people understand. And along with that, this is a rare disease, and no one research center is going to have enough patients for a natural history study, much less a future clinical trial. So very early on, I kind of inserted, I heard about a conference, a workshop that where people were going to, I wasn't even sure what they were going to talk about, but it was on FSHD. And this guy, Chip Wilson, who at that time was not out in public with his FSHD, was kind of the driving force behind it. And so I thought, well, I want to be there, see what they're talking about. And
I
I
like
called
that.
Robbie Tawil, and it just goes to show like the shift in the whole ecosystem. Like he wasn't excluding the society on purpose. It just didn't occur to him that a patient advocacy organization should be at the table to talk about how we're going to, accelerate research. So, we were involved with putting together the first, plans for putting together what became the Clinical Trial Research Network. And then the society stepped in at some critical points when there was not enough funding to fund a second workshop and then to launch the trial network. So, and I'm very proud of the society that we were able to do that, and a couple of key funders. When I said, well, if we could get this going, would you step in with a large gift? And they were willing to do that. I think that was a game changer, because what it did was it created this network, even though it had at the time a modest, $120,000 or something to get it going. Within a year, they received millions of dollars in grants from the NIH and the Muscular Dystrophy Association. So a lot of what happens in science is these big organizations won't fund something until it exists. So how do you
How do you get
create
it to exist?
a little piece of grit to get the pearl to grow? But you can't get the pearl without the grit. So we are the grit that goes in there.
That's a good way to put it.
In the oyster.
It's like, it seems like too, with all the things you talked about, right? You mentioned the journalism, the science side, the communications, those are all within your skill set. And yet you combine them all to build that connection community, talk about the connections between Chip and Robbie and so forth, and creating the CTRN and like getting the funding to grow it and grow it and grow it. Did it just feel like one thing just led to another? It's like a natural path going forward to know what to kind of do next. I mean, you're from a person outside looking in, I mean, you're really navigating a path like in the dark, like no one's really done it before. So did you find it difficult to know like what direction to go throughout this?
It actually wasn't as random as that. I think these are, in the broader world of drug development and things like that, I think people understand the importance of these things. So I think, it was always like part of like I, you know, if I want to get here, what are the steps to get there? So it was in there, but I think these were new ideas within the society and within the board. So there was a lot of really advocating to the board why this needed to be done and why we needed to take these steps that we did.
What were some of the moments that kind of stood out? Like I always say, I even talk about like my children's young path, like especially my oldest through this baseball journey that he's on, for instance, where I can see exactly certain pinpoint spots where it changed or someone that intervened and then it shifted again into these positive directions. And then you can look back at your path and go, oh, I can see exactly now that these connections, these interactions, these people were definite pivotal points in the journey to get it to where we are. So you look back, do you can you remember any significant like almost see it as like a map, right? Where you want to put the little pin pokes in there and go, this is where if this was a significant point and so
Oh wow, it's hard to
on.
say because in a way, in a lot of ways, it feels like turning the Titanic. So you can't say like there was a particular point where the Titanic turned. It's like you just have to keep paddling and pushing and not give up, I guess. But there were a few things like in terms of like trying to shift the culture or the mindset within the society. And I think, and this is not to be critical or anything at all. I mean, the society and Dan Perez were absolutely amazing. I mean, I truly was standing on the shoulder of giants who got the society as far as it did from absolutely nothing, like two patients getting together saying, we got to do something, to having funded the research and having this enormous, this genetic, breakthrough and so on. That was just a Herculean effort. But then then you have to evolve. You have to shift and adapt to the
Right.
new challenges of the times. And I think there was a bit of a like a fear that that if you bring the patients together with the researchers, that the patients were going to either make, ask questions that the scientists didn't want to answer, like, they were either non-scientific questions or they were demands that were not reasonable because patients wouldn't understand how science works, or whatever it was. The two communities were kept very far apart. Like the meetings, the research conference was scientists only. Dan was the only patient who attended because he ran the whole
Yeah, he
thing.
ran it. Yeah.
And then there was a patient education conference where you had speakers come in, but you didn't really have the communities really meeting. And I felt that it was really important for the communities to really meet and know each other and have relationships,
Yeah,
and that
you
we
didn't
should
want them in silos, right? You wanted them.
did not want them in I
Yeah.
didn't want them in silos. First of all, I met a lot of people with FSHD who were scientists who were perfectly able to sit through a scientific meeting and really contribute to it and bring an additional perspective because they had lived experience with FSHD, and I felt that those members of the community would help hold the scientific community, I mean, I would say accountable, not that they were like doing something nefarious, but just to give them a greater sense of urgency. It wasn't just an academic, scientific issue, that there were, lives at stake, and also that people living with FSHD had a tremendous amount of insight to bring. As people start to talk about treatments, you go like, well, if you develop that treatment, like, no patient would want to take it because it would require them to do X or Y or take this
Right.
risk, or conversely, like the scientists might say, well, we can't do an experiment that asks people to give a biopsy because they don't want to. And I said, well, don't presume, ask the patients if they're willing,
Yeah, it's
willing
not
to do it.
great, but some will be like, I got to do what you got to
Well,
do.
like they're willing to do it, right? So I think the first meeting where in Boston in 2016, we had the patient connect and the IRC back to back with a banquet in the middle that was like a big everybody coming together. And it was the first big event, I think, that Fulcrum Therapeutics was there. So also bringing industry into the picture. So that felt like a big shift
Yeah.
in, the community, I'd say.
Was like Fulcrum one of the bigger players then to start with as like a pharmaceutical to get involved? Is that what, why
It
it was
was.
pivotal?
There were two, Acceleron and Fulcrum. And Acceleron was slightly ahead, and they did their phase two trial, I think, like pre-pandemic, the 2017, 2018, that kind of. And before that, there was a trial with, I think, I'm trying to think if it was Wyeth, and so, but I wasn't around at that time. The other shift too, that was the first year we said, people should. The research congress was free up until then. And I think part of that was maybe because it came out of a workshop and you don't usually charge a registration fee to attend a workshop, but also I think a sense that you don't want a barrier to keep researchers from coming to the meeting. And I can understand that feeling, but at the time we said, this is the preeminent research congress for FSHD. People will want to be there, and they will be willing to pay, at least help defray the cost of the congress, and that the industry people would pay a higher rate. This is customary, and and help subsidize the meeting.
Right.
So that was the first year we did that, and it, helped, I mean, contributed significant
Oh,
revenue,
yeah.
made a, and it's grown ever since in terms of,
And how many now has there been those events?
The research congress is every year, so this is probably the, well, this is probably, this year was the 10th that we've had since we started charging registration and so on. And it was in Europe, it was in Amsterdam, it was the biggest one ever. So when I started, I think about 50 or 60 people attended,
Oh, yeah.
and this year in Amsterdam, over like 240 people
Wow.
attended.
That's a lot of growth in 10 years. Yeah.
And the other big inflection point was in 2019, we had the first research congress in Europe. And that was also part of this kind of sense that, the research world is international. And in fact, many of our grants were going to European researchers because they have very strong centers for
Yeah.
FHD research. And and it was hard for people from Europe to come to the US every year. It seemed like we should,
Go
alternate.
there. Yeah.
And actually, the younger researchers, they have no travel funds, so they can't come to the US. In Europe, it's very inexpensive to get around, and they come. You want that. You want them to be part of the community. You want them to feel their work is supported. You want them to be able to network and develop their careers and all that. So, it was a felt like a big leap. It was sort of a fantasy in the back of my mind, like, would we ever be able to do that? And would the board support going more international this way? And then just serendipitously, a French researcher emailed me and said, we were thinking, it's hard for Europeans to go to the US, and we thought we should do a
Yeah, full stop.
conference in Europe, but we don't want to interfere, we don't want it to conflict with yours, so we wanted to discuss that. And I think that was all their intent was, just didn't want the calendar, to
Yeah,
conflict.
right.
And on the call there, I said, how would you feel if we joined, we collaborated into the
Yeah,
Europe meeting
just sit together.
together? And she wasn't expecting that at all, and she was thrilled, and she was like, a great place to, she was in Marseille in France, and we had this amazing, the university owned this beautiful palace on
Gosh,
right on the
wow.
Mediterranean that was also
Yeah.
very inexpensive. And so we had like our first European meeting there, and that was a big shift, because there we became not just your international in word, but in action,
In action. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You brought the world together, all the community
That was our first World
involvement.
FHD
Yeah.
Alliance meeting as well. I mean, there have been a precursor to that where the funders, there's some, the Global Foundation in Australia and the Stichting in the Netherlands, Chris Carino and Friends of FSH, there were funding organizations that had formed a little, what we'll call ourselves, FSHD Champions. But we were focused on, like, let's coordinate our funding. Let's find out what we're all funding and how much, and what should we focus on. And it kind of lost steam, because once we'd done these surveys and had an idea, like, well, what do we do next? And then there were some attempts to get people behind like a research, like a registry initiative, and some of the groups like kind of lost interest, and so kind of went into hiatus. And then Mark is the one who, he had come on board as the CEO, said, well, let's form an alliance of patient advocacy groups. And so that's the first FSHD Alliance meeting we had in 2019. But by that time, so people probably know, like, when we were like a three-person organization, I answered every call from every patient, answered every email, I continued to do that for a very, very long time, and it's one of the, it's time intensive, and
Oh yeah,
but it was
absolutely.
so important. I mean, you don't know what you don't know until you talk to people, right?
Right.
And I think, especially in a rare condition, I hope the society always has someone, people who do that and talk directly to
Yeah, a human
people,
voice, right?
human voice, and you learn, amazing things. And I'll tell you, when you find out about the incredible talent, and I mean, anyway.
Yeah. Now you bring up actually a nice segue there to a question I wanted to ask when you were talking about early on, you're right, answering those calls, answering those emails, having that personal connection. Is there any like story that can pop into your head that kind of impacted you maybe more than another, or maybe there's more than one, if it's maybe a patient story or something of that nature, like within, especially even those earlier years, right? I mean, didn't know a lot about FSHD, then you're starting to hear from people directly.
Yeah. Well, there's one I remember, like within like a couple months of my coming onto the society. It was the end of the year, and the end of the year, you call all of the, every person who's donated to the society, or like you've made your donors, and ask for more support. And so I was just going through a list, and I called someone. I got this woman on the phone, and she told me, she was very angry when she picked up the phone and heard who we were. And she said, she's on her way to visit the gravesite of her son who had died of FSHD. And he had died very young, like, maybe 10 years old, or, and I learned later, that the family they had been donors, and they were actually at one of the patient conferences when their son died, and they left. And that was, that certainly left an impression. I mean, I just, obviously felt a tremendous compassion for her, but also just the urgency of the really our lives on the line, especially, for the very more severely affected,
Absolutely.
and that we can't forget them. And it's a but it's also kind of to counterbalance on the other side of that, I also got a really angry call, I think, or an email from a woman who read on our site that every muscle in the body can be affected, not that it will be, but every muscle is vulnerable. And she said, how can you say that? If I had read that when I was diagnosed as a teenager, I would have killed myself. That's what she said.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And so, I said, okay, how do we message, accurate information without, on the one hand, without driving someone into despair,
Yeah, you don't want the
on the
whole
other
doom and
hand, not
gloom, but you want to be
underplaying
real.
how, and that's still a very fine, but I think what I try to tell people is, for most people, it's a slower progressing condition. And the more you know about it and how to manage it, that can make a dramatic difference. When a doctor says that there's no treatment, that's really not true. That, they're sending the message that there's nothing you can do, and that's just wrong. There's a lot you can do. And at the same time, to recognize that for some, it's a very severe condition and a life-shortening condition. And that I'm hoping that the community as a whole can come around, like, it is all the same condition, and that we should, work together and try to ameliorate the harms, whether it's a, a shortened lifespan, or if it's on the ongoing progressive disability that we should be able to kind of take all of that in and unite to,
Yeah, to do something about it. So is that like maybe like the biggest change in the diagnosis? It was early on, like don't do anything, be stagnant more or less, watch your movements, weights, all that kind of stuff. Doctors are telling us. And then now it seems like the diagnosis, for the most part, I'm hearing changes a little bit. Have you seen an evolution of that, of a change and from what the doctor tells a patient then to what they're currently giving them in news now?
I hope so.
Yeah.
And I think from what I see people like posting about or what talking about, I feel like that message is getting through, but it's getting through to people who are paying attention. I mean, those are the ones I hear from. I worry about the ones we never hear from. They're not on social media and they've kind of, and I know they're out there because every now and then I hear from them going like, I'm
Yeah.
now 70 and I wish I had gotten more involved when I was 30,
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit of that regret, right? That
Well, we're told there's nothing to be done, and they
yeah.
weren't. There was an advocacy organization, and they're not constantly searching online to see what's out there. They kind of are carrying on, and all of a sudden one day they're like, this has gotten to a point like I need to do something, and they look and they go like, oh my gosh, there's this all of this stuff out there I didn't know about.
Yeah.
So
Then it's like getting probably hit with a fire hose of information that you didn't know existed. Speaking of the community, you've talked about working with Alzheimer's as well, but what kind of, in your own words, makes this FSHD community different or unique?
oh, it's, I mean, it's just the most amazing community. So to just, one of the things that makes it different from Alzheimer's, of course, is that people generally, you're not impacted cognitively. So people are very, have a lot of
Right.
self-awareness. And very capable. I mean, people, I like to say people with FSHD are the, masters of adaptation. I mean, they figure out ways to get around whatever issue comes
Yeah.
up. They're very creative, they're very resilient. And just so many really determined people. And really, I guess the thing is, I feel like people in the community are true partners, and we wanted to, me, that was so important, and I thought it was really important, we have people who are employed by the society, but we're all part of a community that only by acting together with kind of a unified sense of purpose. I mean, people have different ways that they can contribute or express it, or different aspects that they care more about, but that we can all work together is, and that to see that really happen and to see people take in the messages and spread it and
Yeah.
become, teach others and so on. That's just been amazing. And that it was just a real privilege to be able to work with this type of community. And it's going to make a big difference. It's going to be why there's going to be a treatment in the, really soon, I hope,
Yeah.
because in Alzheimer's, I mean, people have been working for 40 years with billions and billions of dollars, but they don't have, there's not the same level of, obviously people, family members and so on try to enroll their people or people who are,
Yeah,
it's not
it's a
like
different
totally
way.
lack of agency, but
Yeah,
it's really different.
it's almost, there's like a separation here, right? When you compare one to the other, and then the driving force seems to be the patient involvement for FSHD, which has always seemed to be remarkable to me. I don't know about other rare diseases, if that's a common thing, that the patient is that involved. Do you find it to be more common in a rare disease such as FSHD, where the patients get, almost hyper involved if they can, I'm not saying every patient does that, but it
Oh,
seems like a
but
lot of them.
yeah, well, it could be because I think they also sense that, if it's not them, who else? I mean,
Right, right.
if it's a really common condition like diabetes or something, like, well,
Yeah.
somebody else will step in and do
Right.
this,
Yeah. Someone else has got it. But if I don't do it, this is rare. And I don't know how rare our disease really is. I mean, there's, like you mentioned too, like there's people that maybe haven't reached out, or we don't know. We haven't turned every stone. Are they willing to come out to say something? Some people want to not talk about that they have FSHD, kind of put it on the wayside until, for whatever reason, they feel compelled to then come out, so to speak, to say they have FSHD. When I was at the volunteer summit in the winter there, there was a part called like storytelling. And I thought that was very interesting. That was one I signed up for, and I enjoyed that part only because I feel like that's a little bit of kind of what I try to do. I try to pull people's stories out of them to share them. How impactful is that for people to do that, to tell that story?
Oh, it's so powerful. I mean, we are a species that is geared to respond to stories, right? So, I was in Amsterdam a few weeks ago, and a bunch of us went to the Anne Frank House. And of course, we've all, most of us, hope, have studied or learned about the Holocaust through history books and so on. And you hear the data and how many millions of people were killed and, how many rounded up and so on. But I think the reason the Anne Frank House, Anne Frank's story, has so much resonance, it's just one teenage girl's story, but it, the data can numb you, but you can relate to that one person's story, and then, in your mind, then it magnifies, like, there are thousands and thousands of Anne Franks. It just hits you in a different way. I think it's just
Does.
the way we process information. So telling those stories is really, really important. It makes it personal, makes it relatable, brings it home.
Yeah, it goes beyond then, like you mentioned, the data, which can numb you. I like that. That's a great way to say that. Get beyond the numbers, or even for the science side, like right, get past the cells, get past the DNA and the scientific side of it. And I know that there's been a lot of groups that have been a part of the FSHD community, if it's pharmaceuticals and so forth. I think they've done a great job in trying to incorporate the human element into their work, so the researchers know why are they researching, what are they trying to do. This is not just petri dishes and so forth. This is like people. This is impacting lives.
It's interesting. They really want to connect with people with living with FSHD, and they'll bring all their employees together to meet a family or meet, someone living with FSHD. And they do that because they recognize how motivating that is. They're not, they're struggling day after day trying to get an experiment to work, or wrestling with numbers, or getting, wrestling with the
Right.
regulatory agency. But if they have one person's story that they can carry in their heart and saying, "I'm doing it for, for Carden, I'm doing it for Amy, I'm doing it for Tim," it
Yeah,
makes a
yeah.
big difference.
It does. I think it well, even when you did the voice of the patient, right, with that, with working with the FDA to kind of make sure our voice was being heard. Is that was that pioneering a little bit too? I mean, were there other communities within different disease structures that were doing the same thing, creating their voice to present, or is that something that was more, like I said, pioneering, brand new concept?
It wasn't a brand new concept. I mean, the FDA had created this mechanism, which was called the patient-focused drug development meeting. All right, right, doesn't really
No,
resonate.
it sounds like
Like,
what?
what
Yeah.
the
Right.
heck is that, right?
Doesn't sound warm and fuzzy.
You have to apply for that, and then they said, they have a limited number, but we did what's called an externally led, so we could sort of orchestrate it and invite, and several dozen FDA people came to that. But we worked closely with a man named James Valentine, who had started this program within the FDA, and then was now had a had a consulting practice where we worked with a lot of
Oh, okay.
patient advocacy organizations to hold their own PFDDs, as they were called. So I think so there was a path, but I feel like we broke some new ground in that. I think first of all, we rebranded it for our community. I said nobody knows what a PFDD is, and I can't even,
Right.
you resort to using an acronym that's even more opaque, and it doesn't, and what it is it's about the voice of the patient. We're going to call it the voice of the patient,
Yeah, it humanizes it, doesn't it? When you say that, you know exactly what you're trying to accomplish and what you're trying to bring to the FDA when you say it like that.
I always believe, be direct. Say what you mean. Say what it
Yes,
is.
I like that.
And I think it certainly helped us in, because people, when we started people letting the community know we're going to have this and we want and need you to be involved, people responded in droves, right away. It kind of resonated with them. So, and I think we had, I mean, I think it was the whole thing was like produced really beautifully. I think, I was involved in choosing who was going to be involved. They wanted like a limited number of people who could give 5 minute testimonies. So, and that's what, if you know the community, you can kind of say, okay, this person will give a really good story about this part of it, and somebody else would do address something else. And we also want age diversity, we want ethnic diversity, all that. So
So you know it, yeah, it's affecting anybody and everybody, right? Yeah. Good representation. You've worn a lot of hats, different roles within the FSHD Society. I'm sure those came with challenges. What do you think has been some of the biggest or the biggest challenge?
Well, I would say, so I started out as the executive director, but working alongside the CEO, who was the founder. So, and I was kind of new to that level of like being involved in sort of managing a small nonprofit. So just there's a ton to learn. Just I mean, there are a lot of regulations and things that restrict what you can do, like especially in the area of fundraising. Like I learned so much about, an auction sounds like a good idea until you find out all the bureaucratic paperwork involved.
You're like, wait a minute, this is not this. Yeah, this is harder than I thought.
Or a raffle is considered a form of gambling, and that takes you into a whole nother, it's
Oh
just
my gosh. Yes. Yep.
and then all the financial accounting that's going on. So, but it was invaluable. I mean, it was really, and I think it's important for people to know. I mean, in the majority of nonprofits, I would say not all, like some of them flagrantly violate all these things until, and but to get a, to be well rated, I mean, it's so important. People need to know that there's accountability and transparency. And so, learning those ropes was not always easy. You get your hands slapped a lot. You just unknowingly wander into something like, you're not allowed to do that. And then as the organization grew, I was offered the opportunity to kind of step into more of the CEO role. And I thought about it a lot. I actually did some, had some sessions with executive coaches. I was like thinking about what that would mean and what that, how that would align with who I am and what I felt like I could best contribute. And I realized about myself, like I really like, I mean, I guess I know what I'm good at. And I have no ego tied up in like doing things I know I can do, I'm competent to do, but I'm not going to enjoy it. And I would have myself hire someone else who's really good at it and thrives and experienced, you know, like there were a lot of aspects to being a CEO that I was like, you know, yes, I could say for the greater good, but I just felt like there are parts of doing that that are not going to draw on my best strengths, you know, and you know. So, and I think the board found an amazing person in Mark Stone, who had the experience running another, you know, organization in how to grow, you know. So, and we, you know, partnered, we worked incredibly closely together to kind of figure out like that next growth strategy, you know. And so, and I felt like, yeah, I mean, I don't see that as a challenge. I think it's a growth moment of understanding yourself and what
I
you,
agree.
you know.
But still a challenge nonetheless, meaning I'm sure you felt compelled to try to be in that role, but yet you wanted to do what was best, sounds like, for the community, for the FSHD Society, for yourself, making sure the skills and tools you bring to the table were being used the best way possible. It's
Totally.
really humbling, to be honest with you, to be like, hey, I'm going to be this, title. It's like, wait a minute. That sounds cool, but is that really what I can do best to help this group? And it seems like that's always how you've done this. You've always seemed to put the community first. Like, you always thought, I think from my perspective of how long I've known you within this, you always came across as the person that always did best for the community. But what can I do to do best for the community? A definite, like a we before me, all-star in my opinion, and then the go-to person. And to be in it that long and to do all the things you've done and help sh make things shift certain courses, certain directions. And I know it'll still move forward, even if you're not as involved and then slowly not. But you've made a massive impact. There's no doubt about it. And I'm sure you feel that. So I guess leading to the question is, like, what do you hope people maybe remember about Jun Kinoshita and the FSHD Society? I know it's like a tough question to ask because of your personality, because you're kind of saying, I want them to remember this, right? And it's a little, there's a little ego in it, but I think that's okay considering what you've done.
I guess, you know, I mean, I don't know. I guess what you're saying, I mean, for me, it's really important to always keep in mind what is the purpose, what are you serving? And it's always been, you know, and I think it was a really intentional thing for me to go out and meet as many people as I could, because they are the people, you are all the people I'm serving. I need to know who you are. I need to have that bond. I have to feel that sense of, you know, personal obligation. And it's the most wonderful thing. I mean, people open up to me and let themselves be that person. So I hope that, and I feel like you'll never go wrong in this kind of organization to always keep that in mind, that we're here to try to make your life better, to with whatever, give you hope, give you tools to, you know, give you community, you know, support, all of that. You know, always be an advocate. I guess what I hope is, you know, everybody else, you know, carries that spirit forward.
That's a great way to answer. I knew it was going to be tough. When I wrote down the question, I was like, oh, this could be a tough one for June to answer because of the way your brain and your heart think. And so thinking of that, like, right, what people want to remember June as, great answer. And then people are always going to say, well, June, what do you think? Where do you think the FSHD Society is going to be now, maybe in another 5 or even 10 years, in your opinion, knowing what you know, and all the work
Well,
you've
I
done on it.
sure hope that there will be FDA-approved treatments on the market, and I will hope to be invited to the celebration when
Oh
that
yeah. Oh yeah. So I'm sure of that. Yeah.
And that's just like the beginning of a whole next battle, you know, like to make sure people have access to it. Make sure people always also remember, like, the drug is just part of an arsenal. I mean, you still need to, you know, what mind what you eat and exercise and take care of your mental health and be in community, all of those things you're still going to need and want. And that you know, access to information and good health care are not a given in this,
Yeah,
sadly, you
that's the truth.
know. And even information, you know, like people are struggling to get, you know, power wheelchairs and get the medical care they need. So this community has to be here to kind of help navigate, you know, and
Yeah, navigate it.
the navigator is going to be even more important. And we need to make sure, you know, that the clinicians, the medical profession knows about FSHD, you know, that and can serve people much more than they're serving them now. So, and then, you know, we've become global. You know, I get heartrending emails from people in, you know, just recently, several women in Iran, you
Yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
and right before they started
Makes
getting
sense.
bombed, you know, like,
Right.
I'm, you know, they're all alone. And, you know, I was saying, like, well, let's get, you know, I looked in our database, we had like several dozen people from Iran, you know, patients. They're
Yeah.
not connected to each other. Like, okay, what a difference it might make for them to be
To get
connected.
connected. Yeah.
And actually a doctor there who trained in the Netherlands, who practices in Tehran, who, you know, they should know about. And there are some real outstanding people of Iranian background who are doing work in FSHD. Like, my God, suddenly blanking on his name, Tabib Bordbar Sharif. He's invented this whole new AAV, and his company that he helped start, you know, this company that's been acquired, I think, by, I think it was Novartis. But anyway, his father still lives in Iran, and our, you know, previous chief science officer, Jamshid Arjemand, is half Iranian and he speaks Farsi. So I said, let's get them together on a Zoom, and they
Yeah.
can get
Yeah, connect them.
phone,
Right.
and, you know, and we can support them. So there are, you know, all over the world, there's still too many people with FSHD who are just suffering alone,
Yeah.
you know, and just to reach them all, that's a lifetime.
That is a lifetime. Yeah, that is a lifetime project to make sure they're all get connected somehow. That's like an endless role, right? There might not be an end to that, or a finish line. Within, you know, the things we've talked about, what is then in your horizon? What is your next phase? What do you I mean, are we going to a cabin in the woods? Are we, you know, touring the world? Like, what are you going to do with this all this extra free time? They
There
say,
won't
right?
be much because
Exactly.
I have founded two nonprofits,
My goodness. You're right into it still. Yeah,
and
yeah.
you know, I've been sort of doing them on the side, but I'd like to be able to devote more time to them. So one is a nonprofit called New Harmony Line, newharmonyline.org, which has an amazing technology for making it possible to compose music without knowing
Oh,
instruments
nice.
or theory. It's just a touch, you know, screen where
Yeah.
you kind of draw notes and melodies and start to arrange them and play around with
Wow.
them. So
That sounds fascinating. Okay.
great educational mission. And I'm very passionate about that because I think the arts are so central to being human, and to
Oh, yeah.
give people a way to express themselves through music is really, you know, can
That's
be
important. Yeah.
helpful. So that's one. And then I started a newspaper in my city. called the Waltham Times. It's a profit newspaper, and that's because I'm going back to my journalism roots, and local news is dying all over the country, and I think it's
So is this like an actual paper like you hold?
one day I hope it will be. That's
Ah,
expensive
I
to
love it.
produce, but right now it's a digital paper. And I have, we've gathered a group of, dozens of volunteers and raising funds, operating the paper. We hire about a dozen freelancers. We have a volunteer editorial newsroom. We're trying to get to where we can
Nice.
hire a staff, editor and
Yeah.
so on. But we just launched it in February, and
It's new, it's young, right?
it's sort of
Yeah.
taken off like
Yeah.
way faster than I thought it would.
Really?
So yeah.
Yeah, I
So
think there's
that.
something about that. Even when you talk about, even when you say the word newspaper, I get the sense of comfort, nostalgia a little bit. Like, yeah, you know what? I kind of miss that. I miss having a paper. Why can't I see a newspaper? You know,
Yeah.
where did it go? Was
I
it really
remember
that
as a
unimportant?
kid,
I mean,
I loved getting the paper
yeah.
every home from school, and you like to read like what's going on and
Exactly.
what friends are in there and so on. So right now it's digital, but people can go on and go like, okay. And then people have said, wow, I know so much more about what's going on here than I ever did living here 20 years, and so like a central place that's like the public square.
Totally.
Why were the helicopters flying over the head the other day? And that, big festival going on in the town center, and what, why are our schools, struggling, or whatever, all kinds of what's happening in the upcoming municipal elections. It's all in there.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, and to have like true journalism backing it is important. I mean, people can go on social media and like put their own opinions and stuff, but no, you want to have that like trusted source. What happened to the trusted local source, right? You kind of brought it up.
Absolutely.
It's kind of went borderline extinct, and to have something like that resurgence come back in your community, and then since February you said it's grown, I think you're on the right path there. What a surprise. Something Jun Kinoshita puts her mind to is going to start to take off. That's just so surprising, Jun.
I don't know.
So last question for you. If you had advice to give the FSHD leaders out there, even if it's the walk and roll leaders or the chapter director leaders or paid leadership, even doesn't matter. Leadership is leadership. Or even to the patients going forward within the community, what is Jun Kinoshita's key advice to give?
Wow, okay. Well, keep telling stories about yourself and about the people you meet and care about. Keep telling them, because every time you tell them, you'll get better at it. And don't give up. I
I like that.
think persistence is really, really key. I mean, if you might feel like you're by yourself or this tiny community or people don't care, but you just keep at it and look where the society has come from, just sheer doggedness.
To the borderline community machine that it is, always still keeping the people as its compass north, but you know it's very robust now compared to the, you said, three people in the beginning starting, and look how many people are now involved, the large vast numbers of volunteers and so forth. It's gotten pretty large. It's quite a force now, isn't it?
And I think the other thing I'll say, because I've seen this happen to the detriment of other patient advocacy or, disease organization groups, I guess, is that it sometimes is too easy for factions to develop or people to start feuding about something
Oh,
or other.
sure. Yeah.
Don't do that. It's so destructive.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Everybody can find a place, a niche, and work together.
Correct. And put those niches together. I think that's fantastic final advice. You know, stop pulling against each other and start, you know, pulling and pushing the same way. Let's all do it the same way. Join it together. Well, thanks, June. This has been fantastic. I know we'll talk again, but it does feel like a little bit of you, like you mentioned, kind of a bookend to it. Episodes, of course, will still carry on, but everyone needs to know, like, go now back to episode one and see how that all sounded
Oh, gosh.
after you listen to this one. I don't know if I could do it. I have a hard time listening to myself again after we do these, but yeah, go to the Wayback Machine and listen to episode one with June. But thanks, June, for being here. Everything you've done to the community, thank you, is not enough. It's not a big enough word, but we
Thank you,
know
Tim,
we
for being
appreciate you.
here to be one of the voices of the community. I mean, what you've done with your podcast and Straight Talk is just, I'm so proud of it and wonderful. Thank you for
Thanks. Thank
that.
you. Thank you. Thanks, June.
All
Appreciate
right.
it.
Take care.
You too. Take care. That is June Kinoshita. You legend comes to mind, you know, someone that's been there right away, you know, from the beginning, seeing something that needed to be done, still talks about how she's involved, two more nonprofits, the local newspaper idea I'd love, newharmonyline.org, things that she's still involved with. And she's not going to be a stranger to the community or the FSHD society, but the fact that obviously people need to move on in certain stages of their life. She's given so much to the community, and that we're excited for her, whatever that next step is. I know I am. And you know, from the very early idea of a podcast, you know, for me, it was a source of educational. It still is. You know, when I listen to podcasts, if I'm driving or if I'm cutting the grass or going for a walk, it's like that's my university time. Like that's the time where I want to expand my mind, hear other people's opinions and thoughts, and get educated on ideas that are not mine. And when I was first diagnosed, I looked for that. I starved for that. I didn't see it. And then I did find the society. I didn't find a podcast tied to it. So I thought, well, let me make a connection. What the heck? I had some podcast experience prior and with some decent success, some fun success. Nothing as serious or as purposely driven to help a community like this is. But I thought, you know, people say I have this kind of borderline skill to kind of get stories from people or talk to them and gather information. And I thought that might help the community, maybe give somebody what I was looking for, you know, that voice. And then now it's evolved into the patients. And June was the person that responded to that, talking about how they were thinking about some type of platform similar. And when I brought up with the email, it was good timing. It was good timing. And for me, in my roadmap of the path of FSHD, I could definitely stick a pin for sure and say that's kind of where my direction started to get involved, to start to bridge gaps between people. And bring them together more. And of course, now podcasts have become extremely popular. Everybody would say, wait a minute, you don't have a podcast? And it got to that point where now it's just that common. When I started, it wasn't. When I started podcasting in general, it wasn't. There was, I would argue, say, only maybe 100 or so way then. We're talking like 15 plus years ago, at least. And I've been honored to have that evolve to this from episode one with June to this episode today that we had with her. Yeah, and you know, thank you is not enough. Great takeaways though, and really for me, the one is like, keep telling your story. That advice June gave is spot on. And I hope I can help be that platform for you to tell your story. If you want to share it, send me an email, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. This has been a lot of fun to have this episode. A little bit sad, I have to admit, which kind of like that feeling kind of snuck on me a little bit as we were, you know, tying a ribbon to the end of that conversation with June, because it does feel like some type of end and then a new beginning, of course. So I want to hear more stories, fuel the show, fuel the podcast. What else should we be talking about? What have we missed? Have we turned every stone? Have we talked about everything that needs to be talked about? I want to hear from you, FSHD Radio at FSHDSociety.org. You can follow me on social, follow the show everywhere. You can find it on Spotify, I think Google Podcasts, etc. Tell your friends, share it. Please share it outside of the FSHD community. I think the stories from people that are on this podcast can be inspiring to anybody, not just those with FSHD. I think in order for us to get more involvement and to get more support, we need to spread this beyond just the FSHD community and have it spread to the human community. I think it'll help us all even more. So thanks again for joining us. It's been a real fun episode. Thank you, June, as well, and FSHD Society's support of this podcast. I appreciate you all, and thanks for listening. This has been FSHD Straight Talk.